It's so great to see so many of you here as we come to towards the end of the festival. I'm really excited about this panel. It's the one I've been waiting for and looking forward to being involved in, so it's great to see so many of you here. I am a trustee of Greenbelt, just to say that, and I also work for Christian Aid as well. And I think it's important to recognise how far Greenbelt has come in the past few years. We've had more programming around racial justice this year than ever before, so it's really important to recognise how far we've come. But it's also important to use this unique space that we have as people of colour in speaking to predominantly white audiences, in sharing about our experiences. So some of it might get uncomfortable for you, hopefully, but know that this is a safe space in which all we want to do is to move things forward and move the conversation forward. So I've got an amazing panel with me. So Roderick Greer is currently canon presenter at St. John's Cathedral in Denver, Colorado. There, his official role is overseeing the cathedral's daily and weekly liturgies, coordinating ministry to people in their 20s and 30s, preaching and leading worship. He continues to mesh this with his broader, deeper, long-standing concerns of history, black and queer theology, and racial justice, and Black Lives Matter. And in connection with these, he has written lots of articles, appeared in The Guardian, Teen Vogue, NBC News, On Being, and The Washington Post. And then next to me, we have Professor Anthony Reddy, who's one of the foremost black theologians in the UK. He is an extraordinary professor of theological ethics at the University of South Africa and a fellow of Wesley House in Cambridge. He's also the author of 17 books on black theology and post-racialism and journeying into justice. And at the end, we have the Reverend Winnie Varghese, who is a blogger for the Huffington Post, author of Church Meets World, editor of What We Shall Become, and author of numerous articles and chapters on social justice and the church. She's also the priest and chief justice and reconciliation officer at Trinity Church Wall Street in New York City. So we've got two American voices and two British voices on the panel, so it should be an interesting transatlantic conversation. The first question that we want to explore is, I've asked the panel to think about over the weekend the signs of hope that they have seen in terms of racial justice and the race conversation at Greenbelt, so that we can start with the positives. So, I'm gonna start with...
Okay, well, I often tell students when I teach that context is everything, that everything we experience is in a particular time and space. So the first thing I need to say is I first came to Greenbelt in 1988. And it is, Greenbelt 2018 is a haven of progressive inclusivity compared to what it was like in 1988. So I came in 88 and I literally met four black people across the whole of the weekend. And I stayed for the whole weekend in those days. I was young and hardy, so I could camp and that kind of stuff. Don't camp now. But anyway, I could do it then. And it was a space where black people were invisible. There was nothing on the program, and there were precious few people. So when you met a black person, you was literally go up to them and give them a hug, have a long conversation, catch up with old friends. Well, not old friends, but literally, it was, you met someone you recognized, like myself, and it was bizarre. So in comparison to that, Greenbelt has made significant strides. I think the most enlightening thing for me was the session I gave this morning on Enoch Powell and the 50 Years of the Rivers of Blood. I posted on Twitter a couple of days ago that I was not apprehensive about giving my talk. I think that you get a certain level as a black theologian where you think, if you like me, it's a bonus. If you don't like me, I don't give a damn. So I wasn't apprehensive, but I was curious as to what the reaction would be. And actually, maybe it's because that Greenbelt has a particular constituency that tends to be fairly righteous lefties here on the most part. I mean, making big assumptions here, but I'm assuming that there are not many Donald Trump fans in the house tonight. Actually, what struck me was the level of engagement and the really intelligent questions people asked. Intelligent questions. So it wasn't just a case of oh, Anthony's turned up, he's entertaining us, this is really nice, which was good, but that'd be fairly facile. But also, it wasn't the kind of instinctive gut reaction, kind of rejection that sometimes comes when you are asking people to reflect critically on the nature of white privilege and entitlement, particularly British entitlement. It was a really constructive and mature conversation, and the conversations afterwards were, Anthony, that's really helpful. I wonder if you could help me in terms of how do I do this, how do I navigate this? And I thought, actually, if that's a place where we can come to as a people, as Christian people, that's fantastic. That my hero, many of our heroes, is the great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who once said, as Christians, we need to find a way in which we can disagree without being disagreeable. And it seems to me that if part of that is how we listen intently to each other and ask critical questions, that another of my great heroes, I'm name dropping just to show how intelligent I am, kind of, was actually the great Paul Tillich, who said, there's no such thing as a stupid question, only stupid answers. So how then do we enable each other to ask critical questions in love that are about clarification, but about truth-telling?
Thank you. Winnie, any thoughts?
Yes, yeah, so I don't have context quite that rich way, but for the weekend, what I found really much more beautiful than I thought it would be, frankly. I saw the worship plan, and I thought it looked great. Every iteration of it looked wonderful. But to actually watch a community listen to Black people tell a story, and to listen in the rain, and to listen intently, is just not something you see very often. A large group of people gathered to listen carefully.
Thank you.
A sign of hope that I saw was yesterday during the question and answer part of a talk that I gave. And two Black Brits answered a question that I really was not equipped to answer because of my American context. And, you know, just to see their confidence, their readiness to give their responses, to, you know, speak their truth, was really a sign of hope for me.
Thank you. Any challenges that you think could be helpful to have brought up here that you've experienced across the weekend that suggest that we might still have some way to go? Are we sorted?
it's a relatively trivial thing, but and actually it's not the worst thing that's ever happened to me, but it was interesting, the number of times I have met people who confused me with my brother. Now, as I said, that I've been compared to worse people than that, so it's not an issue. But in a sense, it still speaks to the all Black people look the same to me kind of rhetoric. Trust me, if you met my brother, he looks not that much like me at all, really, to be honest with you. He's much taller, much thinner. We are very different people. And there's still a sense in which that level of being able to confuse you with someone else is, trust me, something I've never done to any white person in my life. Never done that. And as I said, it's relatively minor, and certainly the part of me that's quite proud that my brother is distinguished in his own right. So, but I'm not him.
So I would say, just following on from that, four times over the weekend, someone has called me the name of another Black woman or done the vice versa, and they're not my sister, and they don't look anything like me. So, and I know that these things aren't done on purpose. I know there's no malice intended behind it. But what does it speak to that's going on in someone's mind when they call me the name of someone that they've just met? Or So I think sometimes we just need to be a bit careful when calling people by their name or someone else's name.
I will say, in a Q&A It must have been yesterday. I can't remember. I'm still jet lagged. We were talking about access for Black people and other people of color to Greenbelt. And one of the suggestions for access was that more Black people volunteer for Greenbelt so that they could be able to come, which to me, you know, I think a lot of people were a little shocked by that because it would then create this dynamic where white people attend Greenbelt and Black people are the volunteers, which is probably not the best optics for people, you know, who want a more progressive and inclusive festival. So that was just an interesting suggestion.
It's interesting in those conversations when we talk about, you know, how to get more Black people to Greenbelt, you find that lots of stereotypes kind of get drawn into the conversation. So Black people don't camp, or, you know, we need to make it affordable for them to come, or so that it's perpetuating stereotypes such as Black people are poor and they don't like camping. For people on the panel, how do you try and potentially combat stereotypes that you might come against in your spheres? Do you think that that you are potentially the acceptable face of people of color? And what do you potentially do about that?
I don't know why everyone's passing the microphone to me. Yes, as an ordained person in the Episcopal Church, yeah, I'm the acceptable face of people, of a person of color, of a woman of color. And as an Indian in the United States, I'm a more palatable person of color than other people of color. I'm very aware of that. And I think it's very important if you're in a role like that to be aware of that dynamic and to resist it. And to that earlier piece about inclusion, I was just in a week of retreat in New York, in upstate New York, progressive mainline Christians. And like this, just a delightful gathering, really rich and smart and thoughtful and not who people think we are in other places. And frankly, it was a lot wider than this. So I'm transitioning to more and more inclusion, unlike everyone else who's come from the real world into this space. And we were having the same conversation, that we don't leave the world behind. And the conversation we were having there is that the Baptists and the UCC houses had put up Black Lives Matter signs. And there had been complaints that this was supposed to be a peaceful place and a place where we didn't have to deal with the conflicts of the world. And it was a very interesting debate about for whom that sign meant we were welcome and we had a place and that this place shared our values, and for whom that meant conflict. So it's interesting, you know, how we speak and how we speak to the values of a community. And what came up there was people weren't with that. People were not there, or it was not so lacking in diversity because of money. People have money. All kinds of communities have money, right? It wasn't about access necessarily, that people couldn't pay their way there. It was that we literally were not inviting them, that that speakers were invited. But in the same way that you encounter why, when you think back to why you're here and how you heard about it, that news of being invited and knowing you're welcome actually wasn't happening in all the communities it should be happening in. And this was a place where you could buy a house and have a vacation. So it's a pretty fancy community. But I know lots of people of color who buy vacation houses and don't need scholarships to come to events. And so that, like, who we are inviting, who our friends are, and who we invite in community, acceptable or not acceptable faces of people of color. I'm sure you are not all acceptable faces of white people, I would hope. It says a lot about who we are and who our friendship groups are, and who we think this is valuable for. And I think this is actually quite valuable for all kinds of people.
The poet Nikki Giovanni has talked about in an interview before that she is very resistant to a white person being her biographer because she's afraid that they will paint her life without nuance. So they'll say she always struggled, she was always poor, she, you know, always was disadvantaged, because they can't see the moments in her childhood when she was loved, when she was safe with her family, when her parents would give her baths, the really simple and mundane things of Black life during that era when she was born. And so it's become really important to me when speaking publicly to be very, very clear about the way I was raised and the people who raised me. Because I remember one time, it was actually my field education supervisor, who I love and who is a mentor to me, a white woman, presented me at my priesthood ordination. And one time we were having a conversation, and I had talked about my parents before, parents, plural, too. And I was talking about them coming to visit me at seminary. And she said, "Oh, that's amazing that your mom is coming to visit you," which was this implication that my mom was a single mother. My mom was raised by a single mother. I am not stigmatizing that at all, but I was not raised by a single mother. I was raised by two parents. And just those assumptions that people carry, and it's just a priority for me to be very clear about how I was raised, the class in which I was raised, the time in which I was raised, and the people who raised me, and not letting people who know nothing about my upbringing define that narrative for me.
I've often said in various places that one of the gifts of being white is that you don't have to think about it. You just get on with life. As Black and people of color have never had that luxury. And so therefore, I think part of the way in which I have tried to navigate my life, along with countless generations before me, is that one has to be quite particular about the times where I want to challenge and I want to critique, and the times where I just want to just be me and just ignore that and just go about my life without having to think about all the attendant issues that come with being a male in a Black body. A friend of mine, esteemed theologian guy called Anthony Pinn, talks about complex subjectivity and says actually that what religion is in its broadest sense, but certainly for people of African descent, is being this attempt to be a complex human subject. So we are more than any simple descriptor that people want to give us. That there is something about us that is complex, even to the point of being unknown to ourselves, except to God. And complex subjectivity means that at its heart, none of us is a stereotype. That even if you conform to certain markers of identity, that does not subsume you absolutely. And so the gift of being of complex subjectivity is the gift of just being able to transcend all the particular labels people want to put on you, even if some of those labels are helpful. And it's something about just being a child of God that says, actually, I'm proud of lots of aspects of me, but don't try to reduce me to any single sentence, because that robs me of the complex ways in which I am me, and in which all of us are whoever we are.
Just kind of following on from that, is there any sense in your career, in your life, in which you have felt that you haven't been able to be authentically yourself if parts of yourself conform to stereotypes? So I am also a Greenbelt trustee, but I'm Cambridge educated, quite middle class, but I also like jollof rice, and I like I like music, and sometimes I'm late. So it's difficult for me. So, you know, when I'm late, I don't want everyone to think, oh, all Black people are late. So is there a sense that you might hide parts of yourself or your heritage or anything like that that you have done in the past?
That when I was younger, so I can think of a particular time when I was training to be a local preacher in the Methodist Church, a lay preacher in the Methodist Church. And I was so conscious being the only Black person in this particular group of preachers in the particular part of Yorkshire, that I kind of internalized this sense that I had to make Black people look good, you know? That I couldn't afford to, for my parents or people of the wider community to think that I was letting them down. So I kind of internalized that, and I tried to be a very bad version of someone else. And so my mentor was an older white man who was very, very meticulous. He wrote down every single word when he preached, you know, I mean, into the point whereby he would have a bracket, at this point, smile, close brackets, you know what I mean? Now, to be fair to him, he was a very good preacher. That's how he was. And so I figured I had to be like that. And those who know me know I have a very sharp sense of humor. But I felt somehow a really good preacher is a very serious person who talks about big issues of life and death, and you really shouldn't be humorous. Because after all, black people are known to be comedians and sports people. And of course, I don't want to be either of those stereotypes. So I'm trying to be serious. And the more serious I tried to be, the more I was a terrible preacher. Now, some people know me will say, aren't they, like, you're still a terrible preacher. Well, that may well be the case. But if I'm a terrible preacher, at least I'm me now. And part of the gift of trying to be yourself is that I think the older I get, the less inhibited I am about falling into a particular stereotype. Because that says more about the people who are making those determinations than it does about me. But having said that, it's difficult, particularly if you're the only black person they engage with. Because whether you like it or not, we end up being judged as the representative of a wider community. Not that anyone ever asked for that. But like you end up being that anyway. So I don't speak for anyone else on this panel, but the number of times someone has come to me and said, oh, Anthony, you speak really well. You must be a credit to your community. Now, people don't mean to be obnoxious when they say that. They say that as a compliment. But think of how patronizing that is. I'm a credit to my community, because obviously when I go to Birmingham, every black person gets up and hails me and says, Anthony, like, you're a credit to all of us. I wish they did, but trust me, they don't.
Winnie?
Well, I mean, as an Indian, besides being stopped at the airport, the story that I usually tell stories about sandwiches. I have one about sandwiches. When I was a little kid, I came back to the United States as a 3-year-old. So I started school at 5, and I learned English very intentionally with my parents so that I could start school, so I could be admitted to school in Texas. I wasn't very good at eating any of my meals. Everything that we ate at school scared me, and I was so scared of this food. And if you've seen food in Texas, it was really frightening food, and I had. If you saw the demonstration over there, you guys, I had never seen anything like it. And I didn't know how, I literally didn't know how to approach it. So I just didn't eat it. I had a headache every day and I was sick. And it was a problem for my parents. All I remember is I was scared every day. It would come and it was terrifying to me. And this went on for a couple of years. My parents had very loving solutions and they didn't work. And so in second grade, what I remember very clearly is there was another kid who was from the same part of India that I am from. And she had a sandwich. And people were laughing at her sandwich. And we were in a Christian school. You weren't allowed to laugh at each other. We didn't even tease each other because you'd get in trouble. There was no bullying on the playground. It was a very safe, friendly, happy place. And she was being laughed at in the corner. So I went to go see what was happening. I had actually never seen anyone treated like that because we weren't allowed to do that at our school. And she was standing there, and you can just imagine this little skinny Indian girl, 7 years old, big curly hair, adorable, trying not to cry because they were asking her what was in her sandwich, because it was 2 pieces of white bread and it didn't look like anything was inside. And people could smell it, and they didn't recognize the smell. I recognized the smell right away. And frankly, I would have eaten that if my mom had been clever enough to give that to me, because that I knew exactly how to eat. It smelled so good to me. As someone who had never eaten my lunch at school, so they opened it, and inside of her 2 pieces of white bread in the very middle, which was her mother's incentive, I think, to get her to eat into the middle, clearly she was having the same problem I was having, there was mango pickle. Have you ever had, you know what mango pickle is? Right? I know we're all jealous of her sandwich right now, right? But these little kids in Texas had never seen such a thing, and they'd probably never seen people like me and her. And what I knew in that moment, I knew, like, I had this option to go and be her friend, to go stand with her. And instead, I watched in horror. and hoped very much that it wouldn't come to me, whatever was happening. I didn't do a thing. I still see her on Facebook and I think about it. I just stood there while everybody laughed and teased her and took her sandwich away and got rid of it. So, you know, what we do to conform starts so early, you know, and you're sort of haunted by it. I remember every act like that I did as a kid, where I just watched or didn't participate because somehow I was blending. I had figured out some way, not even to blend or fit in, because of course I didn't. I look like this, right? It's that I wasn't being targeted. I wasn't being teased. And that changed for me after the first Gulf War, when we were being targeted for violence, and our brothers were being rounded up, and people were being told not to go outside at certain times because the police were just looking for Arab-looking people who look like us. And that was the end of, for me, of trying to pretend that I blended in any way.
A couple of years ago, when I was ordained, I started at my first parish, and there was a man in the parish who had great, great, great difficulty with my preaching, the content of my preaching. So not, he may have had a difficulty with the style, I don't know. But it was the content, because he said it was too focused on black issues. Whatever. And I remember sitting down, we had a pastoral conversation in my office, and I said, "How many black priests have you had?" And he said he had never had any. And, you know, our denomination, the Episcopal Church, is 89% white. And the two parishes I've served have been predominantly white parishes, basically all white parishes. Predominantly is being really generous. And that for me, even though it was a really difficult conversation, was really helpful, because I had become neurotic about everything that I was saying. Well, should I not say this? Should I say that? You know, is this going to sound offensive? Will he be offended? Will, you know, these people be offended? And I had to understand, it doesn't matter what I do. Like, it just does not matter what I do. When I show up, my body is a problem for him and for whoever, you know, people who sympathize with him. And so I'm going to, the best of my ability and within reason, be myself. And he's going to have to deal with it. Because I didn't become a priest to change the Episcopal Church or Christianity in general on race. That is not my intention. That was never my intention. I became a priest to be with people when they died, when they are born, when they're baptized, and when they're married. That was very naive, because some people don't want a black person to bury, marry, or be with them when they're born. And so for them, that is a barrier. My race for them is a problem. And so it has been this learning process. And it actually, it's things that my parents talked to me about from a very early age. That, you know, Broderick, there will always be white people who will never see you as Broderick. And they tried to prepare me, and they tried to tell me, and I would not listen, because I did not think, as a kid and as a teenager and as an early adolescent, that people could be so incredibly cruel. But people are. There are many people who are cruel, and it's not because they're intentionally cruel. They have been socialized as cruel people. They were raised by cruel people. And so I think, you know, age 28, you know, I have not been ordained very long. I've not been in the professional world very long. But I learned very quickly that really for some, it's never going to matter how I talk, what I say, how I say it, what I do. My very existence itself is a problem for them.
I cannot believe you're 28.
Wow.
The collar adds 20 years.
No, no, no. I'm not saying you look old. I'm just saying you're, you know, so wise. But anyway. Just picking up on what Winnie said about the Gulf War and how that kind of changed almost your relationship with your body and your colour. Do you sense that there's been a reawakening among people of colour in terms of embracing who they are and standing up against racial injustice, particularly in light of the political context? So I'd say in the UK, Brexit, and in the US, Trump, potentially. Have you sensed a change over the past 2-3 years?
I think there's always been resistance to racism, right? And it's powerful and it's visible in certain parts of our communities. But yeah, in the last couple of years in the U.S., what's happened is the movement for Black Lives is front and center in resistance and is remarkably well organized and structured so that you see people of color in front, particularly on issues of police violence and the death of Black people at the hands of the police. And that is, through social media, visible in a way that it has never been visible in our country before. The last time we had a movement this effective was Ida B. Wells and the anti-lynching campaigns, and that was a long time ago. So in that way, yes. But particularly kind of post 9/11 for West Asian, South Asian communities, I think interestingly we're actually not more visible. I think we're more vulnerable, and we don't necessarily find solidarity in other communities of color. And that's just I don't have an analysis of that. It's something I note. The one time I was stopped the longest at the airport was years ago now. I was much younger, and they brought dogs, and people had their hands on their guns. I was watching who was walking by. It was powerful to watch all the different kinds of people walking by and turning their heads. But nobody, like no one stopped, no one paused. And it was just one incident, but I think actually kind of emblematic of what it feels like to stand, like who is vulnerable in what way and who stands with whom. And I would say the same around solidarity for vulnerable immigrants and the movement for Black Lives, that you don't necessarily see solidarity across groups, but some groups are very, very visible in their resistance right now, and I think powerfully so, and others less. In that I mean their resistance, not their vulnerability.
I'll stick with the US. Any observations over the past few years?
Actually, Winnie had a post, I saw you wrote something right after the election, and it really has been kind of a guiding light to me over the last year and a half, 2 years. And it said, we have to prepare for the most vulnerable becoming more vulnerable, which has, you know, been this profound question for me. In terms of, there was a bishop in the U.S. who actually asked a great question one time. And it was at a clergy conference, and it was in a time in the Episcopal Church when there was a lot of fighting over the status of LGBTQ people in the life of the church and society. And it was something about gender identity or sexual orientation. And this bishop, at the end of this discussion, because a lot of times people will say, people we don't understand, we need to, you know, why worry? And he said that that's actually a great, like a good signifier. The people we understand least, we need to protect most. which has also been this profound question for me. Who do we understand least and how do we protect them most? And so I know that the movement for Black Lives, a lot of work around refugees, immigrants, is really, really visible right now. But then I know all of these activists who were doing this work 20 years ago before it was visible. You know, so like there, it's not that there's a reawakening of our fervor and our resistance. It's we happen to be getting this attention right now. And what's going to happen in 10 years when we're not getting the attention? The work is still going to be done. So I think, if anything, there has been an awakening among white people to things that, you know, Dr. King talked about police brutality in his I Have a Dream speech in 1963 in the March on Washington. My parents, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles knew about police brutality before I was born. And yet there are white people who have lived their whole lives and never thought critically about police brutality. And some deny it exists, period, which is its own issue. So I think among many white Americans specifically, there is this consciousness that wasn't there before. And I think we have always been articulate about our issues. I mean, the same way that a three-year-old is articulate about the fact that they want milk. I mean, these are basic human needs, basic human rights that people are very clear about. And it's not that people are voiceless. It's a matter of if we're willing to listen to them. Who has the mic?
Anthony has the mic.
I think one of the things I've noticed in the UK in the last 2 to 3 years is not that we've not had a long tradition of black activism, it's that it tended to be people outside the church that were doing it. But for the most part, black Christianity was largely pietistic and overly concerned with sort of respectability politics. So I remember when the riots, obviously one person's riot is another person's urban rebellion, depending upon which way, you know, use of language, riots, and rebellion. In 85, and I remember a lot of the black Christians I knew, their view was, well, you know, I'm like, black people, all black young people actually, they should be at home reading their books. You know, that the idea that people were resisting police brutality was seen, well, could Christians not do that? And I still remember being in church the Sunday after the first set of riots had happened in Leeds, in Chapel Town. I live in Bradford, about 8 miles away. And church happened as if nothing had ever happened. We just continued, because actually we were okay, because, you know, like we were saved by Jesus. So, you know, like somehow racism weren't going to touch us, really. That has changed, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years. And I think what has disappeared has been a profound sense of a colorblind theology. So for a long time, a lot of us retreated into colorblind because it was a way, it was a type of progress still, that actually it being perceived as being black was to be second class and to be less than. Then actually you not see my color, and all of us working on the basis that somehow being saved in Jesus meant that we could transcend our color, was seen as progress. Of course, it's utterly illusory, but that's how we felt at the time. And certainly the last 2-3 years, it's been interesting how there's been a much broader coalition of black activism that has come across all aspects of the black Christian community, so from Pentecostal right through to high Anglican, Anglo-Catholic. There's been a sense in which there's been a reawakening of the linking of identity to faith in ways perhaps that was more commonplace in the US than perhaps it's been over here. And so there's been, I've lost count of all the really rich conversations I had with black church leaders who were saying, but we need to do something about what's happening on our streets and our young people. Now, some of it, I think, has come out of self-interest, that perhaps there was a time where it was felt that if you were respectable enough, you might be shielded from these things, and therefore it's all those bad boys on the street that were being killed. So, you know, they had nothing to do with us. But the truth is the world has encroached itself into the church. And we can't hide anymore. And that issues of police brutality, of deaths. The first march I went on was for a guy called Clinton McCurbin in Wolverhampton, who was killed when three police sat on his neck when they arrested him. Now, think of your neck and think of a human body sitting on it. And no one was charged. They got off scot-free. First march I went on, and when I told my dad I got on the march, he was horrified. He was more horrified that I went on the march than he was that Clinton McCurbin had been killed. Now, at Woodlove, I can understand that, because he was thinking that, and they just stayed, you know, I did not come from Jamaica to bring you up, for you to go to university, for you then like, to get yourself in trouble marching on the street for a black person who, quite frankly, was a criminal. But here's the thing about our faith, all our faith, is that we are our brothers and sisters' keeper. All of us matter, even the ones of so-called dubious virtue. There's something very dangerous and corrosive about a respectability politics that wants some of us to get to a point whereby we think that we've transcended the world and its issues that affect everybody else. The truth is, it affects all of us. 6 degrees of separation means that we are connected. And so one of the good things now I see as a black liberation theologian is that this kind of stuff I used to say, that people looked at me like I was utterly crazy. Because while you talk about these things, are now things that even the more conservative black Christians are conceding, actually, we need to be dealing with this. Because it affects us. And our faith is imperiled when we stand back and do nothing, which is what Dr. King once warned all people. That in a time of Brexit, I went years without being called the N-word. And on the day after the vote, I was driving to work and I stopped to get a sandwich. And it's a cliche, but it was literally white van man. A white man in a van. Drove by, slowed down and said, "We're taking our country back, nigger," and drove on again. And the visceral shock that hit me, because I have not been called that for a long time. And I really thought that we got to the point whereby that kind of rhetoric was impossible to use anymore. And it's interesting that in the book I'm writing, I won't talk too much about that. But actually, one of the things I've been playing with is a metaphor, because actually it's become quite visceral. A number of black friends of mine who have suddenly been struck down with, the words just got out of my head. So when you get chickenpox as a kid and it goes away and then it shingles. I got shingles in a few months after Brexit. And shingles is caused by stress. And the number of black people, African-American friends as well, who said actually, after Donald Trump was elected, I came out in shingles. Now, that's not just a biological thing, I think it's a metaphor. What it tells us is that racism never went away, it was just incubated. And then waiting for something to trigger it, and it's come back now in a more vicious form than it ever was in the first place. Because now we're in a context where people are saying things. So, for example, just very, very quickly, in my talk this morning, one of the fantastic questions that came from someone from the floor was, so Enoch Powell did his River of the Blood speech, and he was sacked the next day. Edward Heath, only time I'm probably ever a fan of Edward Heath, sacked him the next day. And so the question was, if someone said that now, would they get sacked? Think of how many inflammatory things Boris Johnson has said, and that has not imperiled his career one iota. We are in a context now where the language of civility has dissipated, where the language of common decency has been diminished, and where the rise of racist rhetoric that we thought had gone away, that we thought that we'd won the argument to the point whereby this kind of thing was impossible now, has now been made respectable. UKIP has made it respectable. Donald Trump has made it respectable. Nigel Farage has made it respectable. So the kind of thing that would have been abhorrent years ago is now commonplace in our discourse. And as Christians, we need to fight to ensure that it's never normalized. There has to be a way in which we can still love people, but call them out and say, that is unacceptable. You cannot say that. And the price for that must be your resignation or at least something that tells you that you will be ostracized for it. It's interesting that Enoch Powell's career never recovered after the Rivers of Blood. He was a brilliant politician, but he never recovered. He was a pariah for the rest of his life. And yet now we have politicians who can speak with impunity and nothing happens to them because the well of our discourse has been poisoned.
So I think that's I've got lots more questions, but I think that's a good place to stop and ask for questions from the audience. Andy's going to take the mic round. We'll do two to three questions at a time and then have short answers.
Picking up on what Winnie Vargas said about being, quote, an acceptable type of person of colour, I'd like to ask the panel, what do you do to consciously to ally yourself with those seen as less acceptable, and what do you advise us in the same position to do?
Thank you. Question for each panelist. Which one book should we add to our reading lists?
How do we make our denominations less institutionally racist?
Short answers. Okay, let's start with books.
I would say, well, one book that has been transformational for me is Will Gaffney, WILGAFNEY. She's an Episcopal priest and professor at Bright Divinity School in my hometown of Fort Worth, Texas. We're never on the map because of Dallas, where Winnie's from. She has written a new book called Womanist Midrash. Transformational.
I would say it's my all-time hero, which is James Cone, who's the founding father of Black Liberation Theology. And he has a book that's coming out. It's his final book. He died earlier this year, and he was writing the book whilst he was dying. And the book is called I Said I Wasn't Going to Tell Nobody. And that is his theological biography. And it is the most astounding thing I've ever read.
And you should just get all of Will Gaffney's books, all of them. There isn't one you shouldn't read. Austin Channing Brown, will you read the title? I'm Still Here, and it is a book about, there's a lot you can read about institutional racism and transformation, it's important. She writes about what it's like to be a human body, a person, that is actually functioning as often as that bridge, interpreting for white people her experience, and she very generously and beautifully writes about what it is like to be put on the spot in different scenarios in which people think they are actually working towards inclusion. And it's just very compassionately written and very generous. Austin Channing Brown is the author, and the title is I'm Still Here, and there's a subtitle that I can't remember.
And I would add Rennie Edo Lodge's Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, which is the opposite of what we're doing now, but it's really good. And yeah, so the first question was around how do we help those who are the kind of less acceptable face of people of color? Anybody got any ideas about that?
I'm happy to give, I mean, it's, you know, I'm partly joking. I'm a queer Indian woman who's an Episcopal priest. I get that there's nothing respectable about me. Like, I'm mostly joking. But truthfully, there is, some of us are more palatable than others, right? My parents taught me to speak English in a very particular way. I don't sound like I'm from Dallas, Texas, right? And I come from a very middle-class family that was very strategic about what they thought we needed so that we could succeed anywhere in the world. But I also get that there are ironies attached to that and foolishness. And what I do, and I actually have taken some grief in the Episcopal Church, and I think it's what we're all called to do. I don't think anyone has a choice not to do this, is use the voice you have, right? I could shut my mouth and be much more acceptable. Yeah, and I think it's the wrong thing to do. The Gospels call us to speak a certain truth. You have that truth in you. It's important to speak it. And I think it's important to stand alongside those that are the most vulnerable in our societies. And it's not hard to find. I think it's really important to do. And I think it's important to speak about the things that feel complicated to speak about. And I think that actually connects a lot to institutional and structural racism as well.
Thanks. And anyone want to take on the dismantling of institutional racism in 30 seconds?
I was sitting in a sermon or a preach, and a person I love, said in their sermon, the illustration was about Mary. And it was Advent, and we were in blue because you're supposed to wear blue in Advent. And the sermon basically talked about this rap song that I think Lil Wayne wrote, maybe. I got it from my mama. And this person went on. I mean, it was maybe a 9-minute sermon, but about 3 minutes of the sermon was spent explaining how they ended up listening to the song, really dismissing rap music, which was so weird. I was like, why are you wasting so much time to like get to your point? And that's this and it was a white person giving the sermon. It's this institutional sort of even shame about being associated with anything black. And I'm like, I'm sitting up here in the chancel with you. So like, and it's just a metaphor for how ingrained and deep white supremacy is, down to the point of a sermon illustration. You can't even legitimize rap music because it's associated with blackness. How do we dismantle that? You know, in our Anglican rhythm of prayer, daily prayer, there is this focus on confession as you open morning and evening prayer in Compline. And I think there's something to that, that an institution can, like an individual or a community, even when it's not conscious of its sin, just say, I'm human, I'm flawed, I've sinned, I know it. I may not know it, but I know it. And seek those practices and those disciplines that hone that sin. The sin's not going to go away. Hate to break it to you, you're going to be human till you die. They aren't going to go away. But neither does God's generousness or generosity around that effort. So as we sin, and I know this is like a weird thing for me to say, but as we sin, grace abounds. I mean, that's the letter to the Romans. And how do institutions find concrete ways to say, I have sinned? In the United States, Wells Fargo, which has been a deeply racist and capitalistic institution, which it's a bank, they're doing this PR campaign because they're one of the causes of our 2008 economic tanking. And 10 years later, they have this PR campaign saying, we're a new Wells Fargo. Like, it's weird because it's like capitalist, But it's like they're saying, I'm sorry to use the F word, we really did, and we want to regain your trust, and we can only regain your trust when we tell you the bad thing that we've done. And I'm not married, but I'm sure marriage relationships work the same way. Like, you mess up with your spouse and you tell them, I did this bad thing. Will you forgive me? And I think that's kind of a really basic thing that an institution can do. The issue is that there are very few institutions that will do that.
Could we have three questions from three people under 30? Two over there.
Hi, guys. Thank you for everything. I just wanted to get your thoughts on white allyship groups or kind of discussion groups or action groups, if you have encountered any that have been beneficial or if you think they can be beneficial entities.
Hi. What do you think the parallels are between the experience of being a person of colour and the experience of being queer?
The new Christian narrative is, I don't mind the foreigners who are Christians being here, it's the Muslims I object to. What's your response to that?
Okay. White allyship?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been part of two institutions where white students have created groups to look critically at whiteness. So there's a whole area of studies called critical white studies, which reflects and critically on the nature of whiteness as a phenomenon. And that's the question, not how do we speak for other people, but how are we allies in challenging the racism within ourselves as white people, but actually challenging other white people. And certainly that was done at Queen's about 15 years ago. I shouldn't embarrass her, but I don't think she's here, so I will embarrass her. An Anglican student called Rachel Webley started a group about 15 years ago when I was first at Queen's. And that really was a response to the fact that there was black and Asian theology, black and Asian theology at Queen's. And that wealthy was raising issues around challenging white people. And then she said, well, what must white people do? And my flippant remark was, not thinking that she'd go away and do it, was, well, actually, what you need to sort out is what it is to be white. She said, okay, I'll do that. And they met. Now, here's the thing. It has to be handled responsibly, because, of course, there are lots of white spaces where black people don't turn up, where white people turn up and play out their privilege. So if it's simply going to be a replication of that, then clearly that's to be avoided. But if it's actually about asking the question that black people have been wrestling with for years, actually, what does it mean to be black? And how do we use our privilege? I've never asked any white person to apologize for being white. Utterly specious thing to do. But what I've said is that given that there's a set of entitlement that comes with it, well, obviously linked to class and those other things, how then do you not speak for me? I can speak for myself. But how then do you challenge other white people and challenge the systemic racism in which you are benefiting from it? That you can do. And actually, the more that is done, the more that we are indeed our brothers and sisters' keeper, is the more it then saves me having to do it. Because at the moment, one of the hard things about the silence of white people talk about whiteness is that I struggle with double jeopardy. So I have to talk about black empowerment and educate white people about their racism. It'd be helpful if all I had to do was just worry about myself and other black people of color, because white people were dealing with whiteness. That's what you can deal with. And so absolutely, those groups are fantastic. The important thing is that you always have to have that critical voice that stops you from slipping into a comfort zone that says, okay, like, we kind of got this sorted now. A really good book is by a guy called James Perkinson. The book is simply called White Theology. James Perkinson, White Theology. Every white person should read that book. It's not the easiest book to read. I mean, he's a very clever guy, uses lots of superfluously big words. But if you stick with it, he wrestles with the nature of whiteness and says, how do white people do theology that just recognizes the contextual nature of what it is to be white in ways that people of color have been doing that for decades?
And then the parallels between blackness and queer identity. Who wants to take that?
And also, Jennifer Harvey has a book called Dear White People, is that right? She's at Union when I was at Union, so she's a student of Dr. Cohn's. It's an excellent book. Queerness and being a person of color. It's a hard thing to sort of tease apart, I think. I personally find that hard to take apart. But of course, the obvious is, you know, I can talk to my parents and the kind of family I come from, my parents and my relatives, about my about our common experiences of being the people we are in the country we live in. I cannot talk to my parents about being a queer person in a relationship with a person of the same gender easily. And it is contested in my community. It is contested in my church, the churches that I grew up in. It is contested in the people among the people that would claim my racial identity with me, and we share the same political experience of, you know, we can joke about being stuck at the airport, and we can joke about who our friends are and who sees us and what those sandwiches smell like. But I'm not allowed to be publicly queer in most of those communities. And it's shifting, and it has to do with my particular family. There are many families that are very good and more open than mine. But it's an interesting break in identity for me as a teenager to imagine what a life would be like without my parents and without my family. And I think in communities of color, you don't necessarily have to make that break, depending, again, on who your family is and what your politics are. But it's a very peculiar experience, I think, that an experience that many queer people of my generation have in common, of having to imagine some kind of significant break with your family of origin. And I think that's still true in religious communities, and it's true across the world, and increasingly also wonderfully not true, right? That kids tell us who they are early on, and we are loving and open with our children.
And the last question was around Muslims and responses to Muslims approach. Anyone want to take that one?
I'll take that. Lest it look well. Sorry, I apologize for talking too much. I think one of the pernicious things that happens within various communities of various types is that different types of people get othered. They get seen as the other and the problem. And at various points in British society, in British history, various groups have been othered. And part of the difficulty sometimes is, I think Winnie spoke to that very eloquently, about that story with the sandwich, that actually there's a sense in which when it's not you, you're relieved, and then you stand back and then let the other group take it. So at one point, if you were a Rasta, you were problematic. If you were a young black and you were a person, you were a Rasta, you were problematic. If you were, certainly when I grew up in Bradford, you speak to the older people in the city who came from Eastern Europe after World War II, they were othered. If you were Polish and or from other parts of Eastern Europe. Certainly when I was growing up, if you were a gypsy, if you were a traveler, there's always been some group that is scapegoated. That's the nature of humanity. All societies are looking for the scapegoat, and it's their fault. I think one word that often gets used in academic circles is something about intersectionality, which is a fancy way of saying that all of us are connected. Issues are connected, whether it's ethnicity or faith or language or nationality. Groups who are othered, they're usually a power dynamic to how that happens. Pretty bluntly, white middle-class men with money don't get othered. Lots of other groups do. And therefore, I think our solidarity is not just with people. Our solidarity is with humanity. Anyone who is othered, Christ is there, irrespective of whether they believe in Christ or not. Therefore, we are called to be in solidarity. So it's Muslims now. You can guarantee at some other point, some other group are going to get othered. because that's the nature of humanity, looking for someone to blame for our dis-ease that exists within whatever social situation we find ourselves in. So actually, you're right. In some contexts, it's like, it's not this group, it's another group. I think it behoves us all to be alongside those who are marginalized for whatever reason.
Add to that, building on what you just said, Broderick and I were, made a new best friend yesterday, and Broderick had this great line of, we met this person because we had to all ride back together, in the middle of the conversation, Broderick just kind of looked over and said, "Aren't gay people just so great? We're just another great gay person." And I think just to add to what I had said before, there's an assumption that the queer people are white, right, and the people of color are heterosexual and all that. And often it's the queer people and the queer people of color that actually are the ones that are constantly crossing borders and boundaries. And so frankly, there's a lot of us here, right? I mean, if you think about the proportion, and that is about crossing boundaries. And actually, there's a great giftedness in that, I think.
Yes, I think it's our final round of three. So I'm going to go two from this side. There's a lady at the back, and then one from this side.
Where's that question over here?
Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for your speeches. I've got a question about how do you address racism and stereotypes of your own community within your own community. For example, when I was 12 and was drawn into Christianity, I got bullied by people of the same color of my skin for being a coconut or for trying to be white, even though I had never considered my race having anything to do with my faith. And actually, the irony was the white people never actually had that same dialogue. Maybe later down the line there were jokes, but the level of intensity and fear of otherness sometimes comes from within your own community. So how do you address that?
There's someone right in the corner at the back who had her hand up.
Hi, thank you so much. That's been brilliant. One of my questions is, I've got many, but one of them is, what do you see as the potential and pathway for radical desegregation in the church? I've just been reading a book, or been kind of engaging with the book called The Next Evangelicalism by Sung Chan Ra, who's saying that one of the key issues facing the church is how segregated we continue to worship in a segregated way, especially in mainline denominations and Anglicanism. And what do you see as the way forward? Who should lead on those questions? What could that look like? And where is an example of where that's being done in a great way? Thanks.
Thanks. And a final one, whichever one you want.
Oh, thank you. Anyone over here? Okay.
George.
Okay, I can see that hand. Yep.
I feel bad.
For the few black people in the house, what advice would you give on avoiding the trap of respectability politics?
Sneaky last one. As someone who is disabled and queer, what I find quite problematic is sometimes when you are marginalized in one way, I see a lot of like appropriation of like black language and black history in like the queer culture. And I feel like sometimes it feels like if you're oppressed in one way, it's okay to therefore feel like you're woke in other ways and just to kind of assume that you're okay. Can you give a response to that and the challenge within that, if that's okay? Thank you.
Okay. Anyone want to take that last one first? Yes, degrees of wokeness, yeah.
And this is something that I'm working on in myself. Just because I'm queer does not give me a pass to then be oppressive to other marginalized groups. And it's something that people, because of hashtag Me Too, especially cisgender males in LGBT and GBQ communities, are beginning to think critically about misogyny, and we have been formed as, you know, socially formed as cisgender men, and with that comes misogyny and sexism. And so we have to be always kind of, I have to always be on alert of my own sexism, my own misogynistic tendencies, and not give myself a pass just because I'm queer. And so, and I think that that then applies across boundaries.
Thank you. I'm going to take the two together. So the stuff about racism and stereotyping within our own communities, and also avoiding the trap of respectability politics. If you, if someone wants to sum that up into one nice, neat answer.
I will have a very inadequate go at that one. Yeah, absolutely. I think we always have to acknowledge that within all groups there are internalized forms of oppression. That they're not just external oppression, there's a way in which it gets internalized as well, and that is also then linked to respectability politics. That when we fall into a centralized notion that somehow an authentic way of being for this community is based on these set of stereotypes, and if you don't fit it, then like you're not really black, or you're not really whatever it is you're supposed to be. And the truth is there are shades and differences even within communities. All of us are diverse even within ourselves, and therefore I think part of the challenge is how then do we speak to others within our community in ways that is about opening up honesty around diversity, whether it's in terms of class, whether in terms of education, whether it's in terms of our different perspectives. Because I think one of the dangers of responding to any type of oppression, injustice from a group identity is that the group then becomes insular and then wraps itself around a certain set of stereotypes around what becomes authentic. So the truth is, when I was at school, the people who bullied me the most were not white kids, they were other black kids, because I was quite, well, basically, I was a studious nerd. I liked school, I was good at it, I was good at homework, and I was a teacher's pet in many places. And for other black kids, I was seen as somehow also selling out. It's a nonsense. And in some respects, it's almost harder to challenge than to challenge the racism or the exclusion with beyond. But I think that's where all of us need good dialogue partners. All of us need people who will both affirm us and challenge us. And actually, that actually goes back to what Broderick was saying. That I still remember years ago listening to a documentary, and it's about the great English Catholic writer Graham Greene. And Graham Greene was asked how comes his books were of a particular quality. They were all very, very erudite books. They sold really well. And Graham Greene paused for a second and said, oh, he said, because everybody needs their crap detector. Everybody needs the people who will hold you to account and say, okay, you know, I know you think you're great, I know you're important, but you do know that's crap. We need people who will help us to stay grounded. And that is also about respectability politics. It's also about the people who will call us to account so that when we get just a little too inflated about our self-esteem, that all of us on this panel have been successful in different ways. And one of the things that happens, and the truth is it didn't happen overnight. You don't wake up one morning with a big ego. It just comes incrementally because people say nice things about you and you end up believing your own myth. And so for me, actually my best crap detector is my youngest brother, Chris. So Chris is black, working class, Bradford, inner city Bradford, never left East Spalding, only one of the four of us who did not go to university. He revels in the fact that he didn't go to university. He revels in the fact that he earns more than I do. And it's interesting that every time I go see Chris, he's utterly unimpressed by anything I do. He just doesn't give a toss, you know? He sits down on TV watching his mixed martial arts, cage fighting, and I turn up and it's like, yeah, brother, what are you doing? And I'll sit down and we'll talk in a way in which he forces me to realize that much of what I do is a rarefied version that is not part of the real world. All of us need a version of my brother Chris in your life, because it just prints the pomposity of being in places like here where people listen to you and they say, oh, wow, you know, I mean, isn't Anthony well learned?
And then just to finish on something hopeful, hopefully, how do we radically desegregate the church?
Well, 89%. I think the Lutherans are worse than us, right? They're at 90-something. 94%, right. You know, what? One of the things that's happened in the Episcopal Church is that people have come from all over the communion to live in the United States. And so when they came in the 70s, when my parents came, we were not shocked, right? We were not welcomed into the local Episcopal Church in Dallas, or the Presbyterians, or the Methodists, or the Baptists. And so we started our own churches. And that's still happening to a degree. You still see people doing that. But in the U.S., overwhelmingly, partly because our churches are failing, you see that now when groups come in, they are welcomed. Like, that's 70 people. Like, that's a lot of bodies. And maybe at its most cynical, and maybe at its best, we care and we love them and they're from our communion and they like our prayer book, right? But what's happened in every church that I've worked in after Los Angeles, so in New York, has been extremely diverse racially, because people were invited, and when they came, they were invited to stay. Our neighborhoods are not segregated in New York City. And people, and Anglicans in particular, and this is true for, I think, most of the main line, people come from other places or from other cities, not just from, move in, and are looking for a place to worship, or we are seeking people out in our communities, and who we seek out, who's in our community, I think, and we've got to start at the congregational level, is kind of up to us. We get to decide. And the churches that I grew up in that were not diverse, the church in Los Angeles that I worked in was not at all. The diversity was the clergy staff, me and the other Asian guy. We were the whole diversity in that church. And I think there's one family that adopted kids of color. And that's what we had in that place. That place then cannot develop diverse leadership, but can actually not lead effectively in the city of Los Angeles, in my opinion. But in New York, Trinity Wall Street, because we didn't have a lot of people living downtown in the 70s, 80s, 90s, we now do in the neighborhood that Trinity's in, intentionally invited Caribbean folks from around the diocese who weren't happy in their churches. We went out and invited folks, and they are Anglicans. They are more traditional than us in many ways, and they were. They're not necessarily now. Their children aren't. And so if you come to Trinity Church, there are times when you come to Trinity Church where you might think we're a black church, which is not what anyone expects to see at Trinity Church. And we have people coming from the neighborhood now who've moved into our neighborhood coming to church. But you can't come to our church unless you want to be around a lot of black Caribbean folks, because those are the longtime members of our church. So that then decides what kind of white folks we get, what kind of Latinx folks we get, what kind of Asian American folks we get, which is such a gift to us. We don't have to actually check into your politics on that stuff. If you don't want to sit by these folks, you're not going to want to be in this church, because this is our church and this is our leadership. And so I think, you know, in the same, we all know this about church growth and church development. If you want to have it, you've got to go invite people to come over. It's like having people over for dinner. It's actually not that complicated, but you'd have to actually be a trustworthy person, comfortable going out there and making those invitations. And what radically transforms it is it means then that people like us grow up in your congregations and end up in the leadership of those institutions. And I think the mistake we make is putting a few people of color in senior leadership in our churches, as though they have an inherent following of people that will come in and fill the pews behind them. And, I mean, he does, but I don't know, and probably you do too, but I don't know about the rest.
And I'll say, I'm not a huge proponent of integrating churches racially, only because I grew up in a black church and it would have ruined it if there had been white people a part of our church. Not to be mean, but I will say this. It was because there was a space. These were domestic workers, working class black people. This was the only place in their lives that they could be away from white people. And so I think if your church is going to integrate, it has to be around, it has to be incarnational, not to use a buzzword, but it has to be incarnational. It has to be in a posture where the fundamental identity of the church is ready to change, because it can't just be about inclusion. White people remaining at the center and then including people of color around the edges, giving us the crumbs. It has to be about, is it welcome? Radical welcome. So saying, I am ready for my identity as a white church to completely be transformed by the welcome of the other, which is what Trinity Church is doing. That's not often the model. The model is usually a white church wanting people of color who then are theologically, socially, and politically white. And that is more damaging than anything else.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being open to listening.